Hi, I'm James McElvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. Today we're in Nottingham, talking to Brigitte Nalisch, who's one of the key figures in the history of semantics and pragmatics. So, to get us started, would you like to tell us how you got into the history of linguistics, and specifically the history of semantics and pragmatics?
Yes, this is actually quite a long and complicated story.
Yeah.
So, when I was young, I was interested in archaeology and ethnography and stuff like that, and I wanted to study this, and my twin sister as well. I have a twin sister, Anita. And then we went to Berlin to the Dahle Museum, and we had a career session there. And they said, no, this is not a career for you. You will not make any money. Just become teachers. So mm-hmm. We said, okay. And my parents were teachers, so they said, yes, become teachers. So we split the languages. I studied French. She studied English, both at the University of Bonn. And I was sort of deeply into French literature and stuff like that. And I never thought of linguistics as something worth my troubles. But that was 1975 when we started in Bonn. And in 1977, my sister actually went for with a DAAD grant to Berkeley to study with John Searle, who died this year, who is one of the fathers of pragmatics. But at the time, we were not aware of that really much. She talked about his dog, for example. But anyway, I went to Reims to study more poetry and philosophy in French and so on. And it was very soft French. And then we moved to Düsseldorf, my then boyfriend, who was a chemist, and me. And I worked with a literature professor in a corridor which was Romanistic. So you had linguistic on one side of the corridor and literature on the other side. I was on the other side. I was with the literature people. My sister became a teacher. I never became a teacher. So after my Staatsexamen, which is like an MA for teachers, I decided to do a PhD. And I asked my literature professor to whether he had some funding for me, and I wanted to study Jules Verne. I actually went to Nantes, did some research, blah, blah. No, there was no funding. So I said, what can I do? And I got a little bit of money from working for a sociologist upstairs who did history of sociology. And so I did research on Emile Durkheim and Gabriel Tarde and René Worms and so on. And said, oh, this is quite interesting stuff, this history. And then I heard about a linguist, Peter Wunderli, who lived on the other end of the corridor, was doing research on Ferdinand de Saussure. I said, oh, that's... So I went to Wunderli and said, do you have some money for me to do a PhD? He said, oh, yes, we could have some money, but you should apply for a grant with the Studienstiftung des Deutschen Volkes. So I did that. And at the time, my research, my grant application was focused on comparing early notions of language as a system and a language as action, because I had had also discussions with Germanistic students on the up-and-coming sort of speech act theory at the time. And I wasn't sort of quite sure yet what to do. I actually got a recommendation from Paul Ricoeur to support my grant. Yeah. But anyway, in the end, I got the grant. I worked for Wunderli on Saussure, which was really eye-opening. I still have his books somewhere here. And then I started to write my PhD, which I finished in 1985. I went to Paris a lot to work in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And the PhD was called La Pragmatique, Tradition et Révolution dans l'Histoire de la Linguistique Française. So pragmatics, history or tradition or revolution in the history of French linguistics. And I made a lot of contacts with Simone de La Salle and Sylvain Roux at the time, who had set up sort of history of linguistics types society, which I was part of. So again, that sort of brought me more into contact with all this stuff. And so in 85, I was looking for a job, and my sister, who had studied English, was in Oxford doing as a lectorin in as a sort of teaching assistant for English. And she said, oh, there's a junior research fellowship going at Wolfson College in general linguistics. I said, oh, okay. I still don't speak English. I'm very French, you know. But I had written an article on Saussure and Wittgenstein, which was sort of my first foray into the philosophy of language, which was called Le même et l'autre. I looked at correspondences between Saussure and Wittgenstein. And at the end of writing that article, I found out that somebody at Oxford called Roy Harris, who was then professor of general linguistics, had also written about this sort of topic. And so I made a reference to him in my article. And then when I submitted my application for the Junior Research Fellowship, I put in the article as well, and also an article on Philipp Wegener, who was my favorite proto-pragmatist of the end of the 19th century. And Roy Harris sort of seems to have liked that. And anyways, I got the job. So I went to England in 85 in Oxford, and I proposed to do more work on the history of semantics and pragmatics in English-speaking countries, as well as French. So I started to write my book on the history of semantics, and then I wrote another book called Change in Language, Whitney, Brial and Wegener. And Brial was another one of my favorite semanticists of the 19th century, who was also beloved by Simone de Lazare. And so yeah, that's how I got into history of linguistics, by some very roundabout ways of working along a corridor at the University of Düsseldorf.
Yep. Okay, wow. Yeah, that is a rather circuitous route to history linguistics. And what was it like working with Roy Harris? I know him only from his publications, and he can be a bit obnoxious.
That's what he was, yes. Sorry.
Okay, so in person he was also obnoxious.
I mean, I'm really grateful to him and some other people in Oxford who sort of saw my potential or something. And I remember him collecting me from Wolfson on the first day of my research fellowship and driving me around Oxford. And I said, oh, I didn't know I was fame, because with people like Peter Wunderlich and also Konrad Körner, who was a big figure in history of linguistics, I always called him Herr Professor, you know, because it wasn't just Peter or something. And so we were driving around and Roy said to me, Brigitte, you can call me Roy, you know. And I said, oh, I can call you Roy. That's very nice. And I felt sort of really liberated from this German hierarchical system. And that was actually quite really nice. He was nice to me. And we did seminars together at Worcester College on Saussure and Wittgenstein and so on. But he was a bit difficult. I mean, I have to say he was difficult. And he had a reputation for being difficult in Oxford. I also worked with another professor called Rebecca Posner and Pogo Davis and so on. And they were all not quite in love with Roy, so I picked that up quite quickly. But yeah, we did stuff together, but yeah, it was difficult. Yeah. Especially as in the end he wrote a book about Saussure and Wittgenstein, which he wrote as sole author, which I was a bit sad about.
Yeah. Yeah, so you also worked with Mopogo Davies then?
I mean, not worked with, but I met her in seminars and faculty meetings and things like that. And she actually, that was very interesting. I gave her a talk about Alan Henderson Gardiner, who was an Egyptologist and a linguist. And I wanted to write about him in about the mid-1990s. And I went to a meeting of the Henry Sweet Society, which I actually joined in my early days in Oxford, when it was set up in 1983. And so in 1995, I went to another meeting of the Henry Sweet Society and I gave this talk about Gardiner. And Mopogo Davies said, oh, what are you doing? I said, not quite sure what. He said, if you don't get a job now, you will never get a job. That was also quite harsh.
Yeah, wow.
And this made me actually think about the fact that it's very difficult to get jobs in the history of linguistics. I mean, it is really difficult. I mean, I was quite lucky because at the end of my fellowship in Oxford, so from 85 to 90, in 89, I got a visiting fellowship in Cambridge to teach for Vivian Law. She went to some research trip to Georgia, I think. And anyway, so for one semester, I was in Cambridge doing some history of linguistic teaching from the 16th century onwards, which was quite tough, but that was at Sydney Sussex College, but I loved it. I absolutely loved Cambridge, and so I thought, oh yeah, perhaps I can make my way in the history of linguistics. But then I came to Nottingham with my husband, and I was lucky to get two grants from the Leaving Trust to work more on the history of linguistics. So that allowed me to finish my books on the history of semantics and then the history of pragmatics. And that was really great. But after that, I put in a grant application to the British Academy to work on Alan Hanson Gardner, sort of biography of his work. And I actually had contact with his daughter and all sorts of things. And even Noam Chomsky wrote me a reference. Wow. And I thought, this would do it. But the British Academy said, no. Oh. And after that, I sort of gave up. And I thought, oh, no, I have to do something else. And I was looking around for a job. I was at the time working in psychology, actually, because my husband was in psychology. So he gave me a little refuge there. And I was in the staff club having lunch. And I met a person I had met in Oxford years ago called Robert Dingwall, who was a socio-legal studies person and professor of sociology in Nottingham at the time. And I said, oh, Robert, you are in Nottingham. I said, oh, yes. And you're in Nottingham. And he was setting up a research group and wanted to get funding from the Leverhulme Trust to look at the then very new issues around genetics and genomics, or socio-legal ethical issues around genetics and genomics. But he wanted to have a very broad research group with linguists, lawyers, historians, and so on. And I said, I'm a linguist. Do you want me? Sort of linguist, I mean. And he said, yep, why not? And so I became part of that research group. And then I had to sort of really learn about science and stuff. So then I had a job and I became a research fellow, principal research fellow, and then professor on the research route, which was quite lucky, very lucky, actually.
Yeah. So the research group was about, what was it about? Was it about science communication at that stage?
No, it was the Institute for the Study of Genetics, Biorisks, and Society. So it was the time when we had BSE, cow disease.
Yeah.
So that was a biorisk.
Yeah.
There was also the beginning of cloning. So we'd have had Dolly the sheep. So it was 1998. There was, BSE, Dolly the sheep. And all this was discussed from a sort of socio-legal, ethical perspective. But he wanted to have a sort of, a broader perspective. And I was also deeply into metaphor at the time, which is another...
Okay, so how did you get into metaphor?
Exactly. Yeah. So in my time as a historian of linguistics, I was looking at semantics. And in historical semantics, people always talked about two mechanisms of semantic change, metaphor and metonymy. And that was since the 1830s, people talked about this. And there was a lot of discussion of metaphor in linguistic circles, in philosophical circles, and so on. So I knew about metaphor and metonymy as a sort of figure of speech and how it was discussed in these times. And then when I was in Oxford, I was doing a tutorial with a young student, but he suddenly pulled a book out of his satchel and said, have you read this? And it was Lakoff and Johnson's Metaphors We Live By. And I said, oh, no, I had not. And I felt very silly because I was supposed to be his tutor. And so I started to read it and realized there was much more to metaphors than a figure of speech or whatever. So I started to be more interested in metaphor from a cognitive linguistic perspective in the Lakoffian tradition. But on the other hand, I also tried to give the Lakoffian tradition metaphor, conceptual metaphor theory, a sort of more historical grounding. So I worked on the history of conceptual metaphor theory in a way. And at the time, I think there was Dirk Gerrits, who did an encyclopedia of cognitive linguistics. So I wrote a historical chapter for that.
Okay, he's still around.
Yeah, he's still around. Yeah, he did. I think he retired about 5 years ago or something.
Okay.
I don't know. Yes, I still remember reading his, I think it was his thesis about leggings, prototype theory of leggings. Anyway, okay. That was great stuff. And so I had a grounding in the sort of the historical semantics metaphor stuff and the philosophy from, I don't know, Aristotle onwards. But I then also had a grounding in cognitive linguistics and conceptual metaphor theory. So that became, in a way, the focus of my research for the future after I sort of left history of linguistics behind, in a way. So when I was working with Robert Dingwall in this research group, which became the Institute for Science and Society later on in about 2006, I looked at the metaphorical framing in the media, in policy documents and so on, of cloning, stem cells, genetics, genomics, GM food, but then also other things like later on in 2003, 2005, nanotechnology, synthetic biology, and then more sort of towards now, so genetic gene editing, gene drives, and so on. So just today on the radio this morning, they announced a new gene therapy for blood cancer, which is based on something called base editing. And base editing was first discussed around 2016-17, after gene editing became popular in 2015.
Okay, is that and, the CRISPR?
Yeah, CRISPR thing, stuff, yeah. Exactly. And so, again, at the time, I mean, I always chase after the metaphors in the new sciences. So I thought this morning, oh my God, did I write something about base editing? So I looked through my blog posts and I found, of course, I'd written something about the metaphors used to explain base editing as chemical surgery, for example. So wherever there is a new science, I try to sort of look at the metaphors that are being used and proposed and so on. And now, nowadays, I look at artificial intelligence, for example, and how which metaphors frame that new type of science. And so, yes, this is quite a long way beyond, say, Brial and Wegener. But
there is a clear path, right, yes. From one to the other.
Yes, yeah. There is. But it's a long and winding path.
Yeah, sure. But do you think that... do you think that there's value in the historical work that you've done on Brial and Wegener?
Ah, now I have to read something. Because in my PhD, which was published in 1988, I think, or something, I started with two mottos. So one, epigraphs, it's called, epigraphs, by Auguste Comte.
Yeah.
Auguste Comte said, "On ne connaît pas complètement une science tant qu'on ne sait pas l'histoire, son histoire." So one can't completely know a science without knowing its history. And Marcel Mauss, who was a French ethnographer, said, "Celui qui ne connaît pas la science écrit son histoire." So the person who doesn't know the science writes its history. And I felt at the time when I was writing the history of French pragmatics that I was exactly between the two. I was actually not a really good linguist at the time, but I loved the history of the stuff. So, yeah, so I was in the Marcel Mauss camp. If you don't know the science, you write its history. Yeah, that's me. And also, but Auguste Comte also is right. I think if you want to really understand the science, you have to know its history. I mean, that's fundamental. I mean, you have to understand the roots on which the tree grows. I mean, it's just, for me, very obvious. It's also really fun. I mean, finding connections between past and the present and between different people and thoughts and ideas and tracing the lineages and so on is really, I think, yeah, just a lot of fun. So it's a bit like, sometimes I call myself a sort of like a butterfly hunter. You go with your net and you catch sort of ideas and you put, it's a bit cruel, put them on a board and you sort them out. Let's not talk about butterflies. Fossils, much better.
Okay, collect fossils. They're already dead. So,
exactly. <yeah. laughs> And then you sort them into taxonomies or you find whether, I don't know, the missing links and so on. So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. But is it just interesting or does it, or can you actually use it?
If you don't know about the history of Crick and Watson's discoveries and how they were made and how they sidelined Franklin and where they come from and where they met and how... I mean, it's a whole edifice is sort of without a foundation, I think. You need the foundation to understand where, say, the discovery of the double helix comes from and how it was done and rightly or wrongly in certain cases when people were missed out or not and so on. It also gives a sort of human flavor to science, which sometimes gets lost in the abstractions. So, I don't know. So once when I was still trying to do real linguistics, I sort of sat there and thought, do I really want to do, I don't know, the morphology of the blah, blah, or whatever? And my husband said, oh, you no longer want to do the nose-picking glottal stop, do you? Yeah. And sometimes this sort of type of linguistics sort of leaves me slightly flat, I think. I like more the sort of the nitty-gritty human stuff of the actual people doing the linguistics.
Yeah.
But I think it's also fun for the students to know where they come from and what they do and so on, yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've actually covered most of the things that I wanted to ask you about.
I think there's one thing perhaps you asked how my linguistic stuff sort of links up to my sort of more sciencey things. So one thing which is interesting that when I started to work with the Institute for Science and Society, I thought, oh no, I don't know anything about science. I mean, science had been a complete black box for me for a long time. So how do I do this? So I suddenly realized that when I was doing my history of linguistics, I looked at a lot of adjacent sciences that influenced how linguistics was done or how it was. I mean, for example, Schleicher was influenced by Darwin. Max Müller corresponded with Darwin. Darwin was influenced by Lyell. Lyell's uniformitarianism influenced linguistics. And so when I was doing history of linguistics, I looked at a lot of the adjacent sciences like biology, geology, psychology, philosophy, and so on. So I had some inkling of what was going on in the 19th century in science. But the real sort of modern science still sort of escaped me. But then in 1991, I became a committee member of the Henry Sweet Society, and I was quite proud. But then I got pregnant, which was fine. Mm-hmm. And my son was born in 1991 as well. And my husband is a scientist. So when my son was growing up, just between 1991 and 1998 was the time when I had to integrate myself into the Institute for Science and Society group. My son and my husband were deeply into science. So we had the new scientists around the house. We watched the Christmas lectures. When we went to McDonald's, they scribbled funny scientific things on the napkins. And it was also the time of the growing public awareness of BSE and GM food and so on. So I was gradually sort of induced into science through my family in a way. But again, with having a little grounding in the history of science, sort of Darwin, Lyell and so on, which sort of gave me sometimes a way of actually speaking to my husband, my son, and saying, but you know, Darwin almost so said, so when they were talking about whatever, genomics or something. So the history of linguistics actually gave me also a grounding in the history of science, which then gave me a starting point to actually talk about science with the scientists.
Yeah, so thank you very much for answering this question.